Welcome to Entrepreneur Clinic with me, Monique Chambers, and every week I'll be interviewing a special guest talking about how to set up a business or how to launch a new product in the local market. You're listening to Entrepreneur Clinic with me, Monique Chambers, on Campus FM. This is a new 17-part series on setting up your own business or launching a new product. This week, we have Professor Russell Smith joining us, telling us how you know if you have a good idea. So, Russ, what are the elements of a good idea?
Well, I think it's a really difficult question to answer. Although it sounds like a simple question, it's actually quite a complicated question. The first thing is not so much about what it is you have invented or thought of. The first thing is, what's the problem? There has to be a problem. People buy things when they solve a problem. So, if you can think of a problem and you can solve that problem with a product or a service, then I would call that a good idea. So, I'm making the distinction here between just intelligent thinking good ideas and commercial good ideas. And commercial good ideas solve a problem, and that's what we want. What I want people to think about too is what are the benefits that that idea brings with it, the product or the service, because that's really what you need to be thinking about. What are the benefits to the person who's buying it? Solving a problem, but what are the benefits? So problem solving and benefits.
Okay. So sometimes an idea you see is so simple, why hasn't somebody thought of this before?
Yeah.
How do you prove then that your idea is not so simple at the end of the day? Or that,
well, I think the classic example of why hasn't anybody thought of this before relates to when food for preservation was first tinned. The first tin can opener didn't emerge for about 60 years after the tin can process was invented. So sometimes you just don't need it. And why didn't they need it? It was for the troops, and troops had daggers or swords or whatever, so they didn't need it. So sometimes a good idea arises because it's just possible to make it in a way because technology's changed or something's happened. But generally speaking, a lot of good ideas, people kick themselves. They're simple ideas. Why didn't I think of it before? It's just the way of it, I'm afraid. There's no rhyme or reason or rule around that.
So once you think you have this problem-solving idea, what do you do next?
Well, I think a good example would come from, say, in the UK, a man called Simon Woodruff, who came up with Yo Sushi, which was the sushi sort of restaurant on a conveyor belt, decided that the problem he was solving was an unusual choice of lunch, and that would solve people's hunger, and it was a bit different. But for him, the next thing is how many people wanted it. So he literally stood at all different locations over London with a clicker, just pressing it with his thumb, a counter, just counting footfall. So it's, can you actually get it to market? Will people know about it and buy it? So it's not just about whether it will solve one person's problem. It's got to solve lots of people's problems. And so you can then generate a return, which will ultimately make you a profit.
So can one assume that one has a good idea because you have the need yourself? Was this just people counting going for lunch? Did he then take that further and talk to them about their choices of lunch?
Okay, to use that example, I think what he was looking at to begin with was not necessarily the choice of people, but the choice of location, where enough people walking past so that there was footfall in that particular area. But you're talking also about critical thing about market research, and it's absolutely vital to know whether enough people would want to buy it. And to be honest, Monique, would they buy it at a price that you must sell it at in order to make a profit? Now, honestly, I don't care what you do with the profits, but you've got to make one. You know, you can spend it on cocktails in the Bahamas, or you can give it to charity. It doesn't matter, but unless you make a profit, you will go out of business, and then that's the end of the story. So you've got to make sure you can sell enough things at a price that you can make a profit. And you've got to be very open to the difficult, bad information, the things that you might not want to hear. So in other words, don't ask friends and family. That'll tell you it's marvellous, you know?
So you would go out to do market research to a general audience to start with, or you think you have a generic idea of who your audience should be and you start there?
I think people who are good at business, and I'm not I'm not so fond of using the term entrepreneur. I think different people mean different things by entrepreneur. It's certainly very different from an inventor, the person who has a creative idea. The person who's good at business is good at enterprise. Entrepreneurs, they're, I think, people who've been good at more than one business in different areas of business activity. In other words, they can apply principles and approaches and they've been successful more than once. Otherwise, they might just be lucky. Or you could be a plumber. I mean, I've never met a poor plumber. So it's just, you know, it's one of those things where I think it's got to be very careful about how you think about all these things, but you've got to get the right information, you've got to have a clear idea of what it is, but it's about the business process, and the actual product or the service matters less than you knowing about the process.
So this process,
yeah.
Where do you start?
Well, I think in terms of enterprise, that sounded like an opening for me to plug my book, but I won't do. So I think for that kind of information, there's a huge amount out there available via the internet. So an overwhelming amount, to be truthful. So I think one of the things, if you're lucky enough to be in close proximity to the university, is come and talk to people at Takeoff, which is the incubator facility. Lots of people there who are happy to share ideas and advice. And within CEBI, C-E-B-I, the Centre for Entrepreneurship and Business Incubation, again, it's our remit to try to help people who've got good ideas look to see if they can turn them into commercial, you know, opportunities. If you don't have access to that, then, you know, there are a number of websites that one can think about, or just buy a simple how to do it book, but it's the process of enterprise that you need to know about. Entrepreneurship will follow. Enterprise is the key thing you need to know about.
Are there main principles that you should?
Yes, I think there are. I would just repeat slightly what I said at the top of the program, which was that you have to find a problem, that you need to have a product or a service that solves that problem, and you should always be thinking about the benefits that you're offering. And, you know, you've got to know who it is that this product is for. For example, my son Rowan, who's 16, very good badminton player, tells me he's going to play for England one day, just so long as I buy him all the Yonex top-of-the-range products. He also mentions that he's going to choose my care home, so it's a bit of a bit of a sort of lever there, but essentially I'm the purchaser, he's the beneficiary. So all of the marketing to Yonex does, very sensibly, is to market to him as the person who's the beneficiary, but I'm going to be buying that. So you've really got to know who's paying, who's the beneficiary, and therefore knowing your market is critical.
So that brand would also, or should also, target the purchaser, not just the person they want to convert, the person that wants to actually be the end user of their product.
I think that can be very valuable, but equally I would say that it's less critical. You know, the end is supply and demand. The demand is created by promoting it to my 16-year-old, who then turns to me to fund it. So I think the person who's going to ultimately use it is the one where you're creating so-called pull-through. So they want you to sort of, you know, get them really, you want to get them energized about why they should be using it. And I think that's a very important sort of type of marketing. Often where you would use celebrity endorsements. So whether it's football boots or whatever it happens to be, or makeup, you know, the celebrity endorsement bit, I think, is stimulating a need. Apple are classic at that, and they were fantastic. They had an iconic poster years ago with a picture of a man called Richard Feynman, who was a bit of a hero of mine. He's a very, very clever man. Two Nobel Prizes, if I recall. One for quantum electrodynamics, very difficult sums. So this is a really clever guy. And they just had a photograph of him, and it said, "Think different." And at the bottom it just said www.apple.com. I don't think that was the first poster, just to quote only a website, but it was one of the first. And the clever thing there is that they were saying, if you buy a product like ours, you'll be like Richard Feynman. So again, you know, I think it's about that endorsement, either explicit or implicit.
And then I guess educating the parent or the payer on the product, so that they are happy to go ahead and buy and not just be, you know, have them be manipulated by their child into.
I think that can be extremely helpful, but sometimes it's very difficult to do that. For example, picking up with Apple, the iPhone 6. You know, Rowan tells me he needs an iPhone 6, though he has an iPhone 5, or I don't really know the difference, and that if I don't buy that, it's going to, again, ruin his life. And I'm not sure that the features of the phone are really what he wants, or that it's much more important to possibly impress Emma, his badminton partner. I don't know why he wants that. So persuading me, if Apple were to persuade me about the benefits of the features, I'm not sure that that would make any difference.
Because you're still going to buy on impulse and emotion, essentially.
I'm going to try to buy on value in terms of value for money. I think my son's assessment of value is a little different.
So that's quite an interesting way of looking at it, and I think we all do it, actually.
Yes.
In our own ways.
Sure.
So you were talking earlier about SEBI and how you can teach people or help people along with these ideas and ways of thinking. Can you tell us a bit more about some of the courses that they run there? So,
well, the flagship course, I guess, at the moment with SEBI is the so-called MEnt, Master in Entrepreneurship. And this was a very deliberate departure from traditional ways of teaching, so that we have 4 weeks of very intensive, it has to be said, teaching, with lots of assignments and lots of group exercises too. But all of that is about teaching the principles of enterprise and entrepreneurship. Every assignment that the student undertakes is the creation of a business document. So whether it's a job description or an advert or a brochure or a business plan or a cash flow forecast, every assignment is a business document that will be useful later in life. So that forms 4/9, 40 ECTS out of 90, and once completed, we then go on to work with the individual to take their idea and help them to create a fairly substantial market appraisal. So it is market research, but it's also looking at the types of people who might be buying it and can I make this at a price where I can make a profit and so forth. And if that's successful and that forms their first dissertation, they go on to do a second dissertation, which is a business plan. And that's the key be-all and end-all about the start of a business. You have to have a plan. Not a telephone directory or a PhD thesis, 30 pages or less.
Okay.
Very simple, very straightforward. 1 page per year for a budget, what we call a cash flow forecast. So very simple. And the viva, as part of this master's course, is a funding presentation, as if they were going to the bank or to an investor for money in real life. So we've tried to mimic the process of how that works over the sort of natural history of starting a business. Now, that's been drawn from work that we've done in the past, over the last 20 years, and that program that was developed has been used by a range of different people, from very clever academics with a new cure for cancer, quite literally, through to disabled people working from their bedroom because they can't get out of the bedroom. So a very broad spectrum. And I think the pleasing thing is that the same principles help people with a business, whatever it is. About 80% of the information you need is going to be the same. 20% will differ. And we found that over the years that people have been using that, and more than 3,000 people have now, they've raised over 100 million euros in business finance. So it seems to work across the board. But the most pleasing thing is that we've followed the program in terms of whether or not the business was sustainable. And we can certainly make a big difference on sustainability. You may not know that more than half of businesses fail in the first 3 years, which is quite a harsh statistic. So we have to do something about that.
And so this course, it's run in Malta only, or it's run in other locations?
So the course that we're speaking of, the Masters from SEBI, is the really the technology transfer version of that, which is to say, if you are an academic or you have a fairly sophisticated idea, then we can take you all the way through and help you raise the millions of euros that you need. But versions of that and earlier versions have been used with a variety of different situations, from disadvantaged groups through to younger people, ex-forces personnel who retire for medical reasons, through to the sort of academics too. So it's the basic principles that we've been using, and that's been done in Italy and Latvia and the UK and elsewhere.
So do you have to have an idea before you come on this course, or...?
No.
Does it help?
No. I think that's one of the really interesting things about SEBI, okay, is that we have recognised, because that we're involved altogether with the Knowledge Transfer Office, which is to say, if you have academics here, you've got a great idea, but they don't want to be a business person. They want to be an academic because they like research, and if they've come up with some invention, they're obviously good at it. So why wouldn't we want them to continue doing research? So what we say to people who come on the Masters in Entrepreneurship programme is, if you don't have a good idea, then we can match you with a university opportunity and put the two of you together. So I think that's quite a clever way forward, really.
Absolutely.
And we've got over 50 now on the island who've qualified through this, and you know, the next couple of years we'll have over 100, so we'll soon have quite a lot of people, I think, who can develop good ideas, but may not necessarily have one on their own.
And is there a shortage of good ideas in Malta, or is there going to be plenty to be able to feed?
I think the astonishing thing is, and I've been involved in this kind of thing for about 25 years now, is that there is an overwhelming amount of good ideas. And when you start a business, I can guarantee that the thing you'll be doing in 3 years' time isn't what you thought. You'll have had lots more good ideas. You'll meet people with other good ideas. So there are lots of good ideas. Entrepreneurs are just good at choosing which are the best.
And that's the best in terms of making a profit at the end of the day, or
being sustainable. I think it's about doing things that you think you can sustain. Now, that sometimes means making a profit, but it could be a social enterprise activity whereby you're doing something for public benefit, and it may be partly funded by grants or government. But yes, you have to actually make ends meet.
You're listening to Entrepreneur Clinic on Campus FM with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Professor Russell Smith from SEBI. We're discussing good ideas and how to know that you have one. Russ, you mentioned earlier in the programme that you've written a book recently.
Well, the book came out of an interesting project that we ran with 150 new businesses, and they all started pretty much in the first week of January on a particular year, and we followed them over a year, and over that period of time, I hired 9 MBA graduates, so business school graduates, and they did 2,500 interviews with those people who started a business. And it was really quite interesting to see the challenges that they faced in business. They weren't all that we'd predicted. We thought we knew pretty much what they'd face, but there are often challenges that we thought they would have that they didn't have, and challenges that we thought were not so problematic that were problematic. So it's a very interesting piece of work, and then we tracked those people over the following 5 years, and we showed that just providing people with basic information about business when they need it was very valuable, because the overwhelming problem that people have is the amount of information on the internet. It's just huge. So we came up with a slightly non-academic approach of saying, okay, reading requirement of 1 page per day, 6-page module, and a 1-page fact sheet that summarises it, provide you with one of those every week, so the 7 pages, and that's a page a day. And if we can think of all the things you need to know and condense them into sort of 48 packs, we can email those to you, and that's very straightforward. Now, I've got to be honest, Monique, it took us 18 months to fight our way to agreement over what the content should be, but it seemed to work okay. So what I can tell you is that improving a person's basic understanding of business and financial marketing topics can make a big difference. And we found that we halved business failure rate. So that's quite a small amount of information that's in a structured, sensible way can make a dramatic difference to business failure.
So what were the surprises that you found? What really stood out?
Well, first of all, we read quite a lot of information, and we still get it, in the popular press in the UK about how red tape bureaucracy is strangling business. We didn't find, of the 2,500 interviews, I don't think one question came up about red tape and bureaucracy. It was not a problem. And our bit of key advice, for example, was don't waste your time trying to turn yourself into an accountant. Pay your accountant. So in terms of things like calculating salary and taxation on a monthly basis for what you have to pay in somebody's account, accountants have a computer program that does that and charge you maybe 10 euros a month. You know, just get on and do something more valuable. So what we found was that red tape wasn't a problem, and that surprised us a bit. We thought it might be. In terms of where we found problems that we hadn't really realised was the businesses where people did not pay themselves to begin with. So they often said, yep, my business is successful, I've made 30,000 euros this year. And the first question is, but how much did you pay yourself? Oh, I didn't pay myself anything. Well, then you haven't made any money. Oh, yes, I have. My accountant says I've made 30,000 profit. So getting people to understand that they were funding their own business and running up credit card bills and borrowing from friends and family all has to be repaid in the end. And our attitude that we took was, look, banks are banks. I'm sure they're all jolly nice people, but banks are banks. Friends and family, they're rather more important. And so when you borrow from a bank, take it seriously. When you borrow from a friend or family, take it very seriously. So again, some difficulties arose because people were just thinking it was a rather unpleasant phrase, but sort of soft cash, just easy money, borrowing from bank of mum and dad. But that's not the way to approach it. So not what we thought.
So you said that you'd helped to reduce the fail rate quite dramatically.
Yes, yes.
Was that purely through the education or...?
Yes, we believe so. And the key thing, I think, that made the difference was having people understand where they were on a financial basis day to day. Very accurate predictions about what they might sell. Most people are over-optimistic about sales. And very accurate predictions about what things will cost. Most people forget certain things. So you end up with a business that all businesses go negative money-wise to begin with, and that's just part of it. But then ultimately you have to begin to sell more, make a profit, and then turn it around and become profitable. Most people fail because they keep putting their own funds into it, they keep going and going and going and going, and then about year three it crashes because they've run out of their own funds.
So you can actually teach people almost when to pivot, I guess, or when to cut the ribbon.
Very much so. Very much so. And very simple lessons. It's not complicated. You know, the whole process of business planning sounds like you should go to university for 3 years to learn how to do that. No, it's straightforward. It's about what you intend to do, how you intend to do it, when and what it will cost over perhaps a period of 3 years. And that's more than, you know, I haven't yet found somebody that I've helped who I couldn't get to prepare a business plan. And if you write it on the back of a cigarette packet, frankly, I'll still be happier than if you have no plan at all. But without a plan, you're likely to be in trouble.
So plan obviously being very important and the good idea, but what should potential entrepreneurs and business owners be aware of before they even start? Because there's obviously a glamorous view that you can work part-time, you can have your dog in the office, you can have holidays when you please. What are the things that actually you've noticed or you would highlight to people before they set out on the journey of being an entrepreneur?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say to them is forget this journey to become an entrepreneur. You know, start in a more structured, measured way. The first thing is learn about business, learn about enterprise. It's a very straightforward concept. You can break it down into a series of steps and therefore you can learn about it. So learn as much as you can about enterprise. The second thing I would say is that you're going to work hard. Yes, you can wear a t-shirt. Yes, you can have your dog in the office if you want, if it's your business. But you will never work for a tougher boss than yourself. And you will be working all night some nights, and you will have things that go wrong and are difficult, but it is extremely rewarding as well. So, you know, it's exciting, but be prepared to be surgical rather than medical. Now, what I mean by that, my background is medical, so what I mean by that is that rather than trying to sort of make things better and better and better, you have to know when to cut it out and stop. So people who go on to become good entrepreneurs often know when to stop. Is that a failure? No, because entrepreneurial people usually have at least three businesses on the go at the same time, or three ideas. So again, don't think of it as one job, think of it as one of your many jobs.
So, Russ, if somebody wanted to come and talk to you about their idea, how could they do that?
Well, just drop by to the SEBI office and pop along and have a coffee. There are plenty of comfy seats there and lots of coffee. So happy to have a chat and talk about ideas, particularly from people within the university, because often academics say, oh, this kind of thing isn't really for me, you know, I'm an academic. And I ask them, well, what do you do? Well, I teach and I supervise PhD students and I do some consulting work, and I, by the end of the conversation, it's clear they have at least seven jobs, Monique. So people are much more entrepreneurial than they think. So pop along, have a chat, and we'll see if we can help.
And so that's the SEBI office based at Takeoff?
Yes,
at the University of
the
North
third North. Floor. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. And then once you've had the chat, what are the services that you offer there that can help people take their idea forwards?
Well, I think coming into Takeoff, if you want to start a business and make it happen, is a very positive thing, because there's a group of like-minded people, there are supportive people there who can help you, bring you into contact with financiers and a range of other things. But I think just get involved with some of the events that they put on. So look what's happening in the Takeoff thing. There's events most weeks. Come along to those, talk to people, and begin to think whether you'd like to take it forward. If you do, then we can help you with some kind of plan. That's the first step.
So that's actually helping with the business plan that we've
yes,
mentioned.
Yes, we can help with things like that, but we want to just plan it out, and we can use different tools. I would like to have, for example, a one-page document that says, what have you got, what problem does it solve, and what benefits does it bring? From that, we can create a business, Mike.
Okay, so I hope you'll be absolutely inundated with new ideas from our listeners.
I'll be delighted, yes.
Excellent. So you've been listening to Professor Russell Smith and myself, Monique Chambers, here on Entrepreneur Clinic on Campus FM. Next week, I'll be talking to Martina Patch in depth about protecting your idea. You've been listening to Entrepreneur Clinic with me, Monique Chambers. The programme is aired every Wednesday on Campus FM at 9:30 a.m. and repeated on Thursdays at 1:30 p.m. Join us again next week to hear more about your journey in starting up a new business or launching a new product.